Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Lowy Institute. I'm Michael Fullilove. I'm the director of the Institute. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this event, which was organised very late. So thank you for joining us. I have some good news. I've checked my phone just before we came on stage, and there's been no change in the Prime Ministership since you entered 1 Bligh Street. So things are safe. But nevertheless, even with no change today, let's review the numbers. No Prime Minister has served a full term since Mr. Howard. We've had 5 Prime Ministers in 5 years. By next year, it will likely be, if you believe the bookies, 6 Prime Ministers in 6 years, at which point we will officially overtake Italy in terms of Prime Ministers in the past half decade. I think this puts an end to the talk that was around at the time of the last leadership change. I remember some ill-informed commentators poo-pooing the idea that there was something serious at stake and saying, well, we've been through this before, and the end of the 1960s, there was a lot of churn, and this just happens from time to time. I think now, with, by my calculation, 4 changes of Prime Minister through the party room rather than through the ballot, and all these changes in leadership, and not only the changes at the very summit, but it trickles down to changes to Defence Minister and Treasurer and so on. I think we can say that this is not a cyclical issue. There is something deeper and more serious at play, and therefore it obviously has serious implications for us as a country. So when the latest putsch came to a head last week, we decided to bring some of my brilliant colleagues from the Lowy Institute together to have a yarn about exactly these issues. And I'm joined on the end by Richard McGregor, who joined the Institute earlier this year as our Senior Fellow on East Asia, who was for many years worked in the gallery as a gallery journalist, but also as a foreign correspondent for the FT and other newspapers in Shanghai, in Beijing, in Washington and elsewhere. So a very well-informed and experienced observer of Australian politics and indeed global politics. Next to Richard is Sam Roggeveen, who has been again with the Institute for the better, in Sam's case, has been with us for the better part of a decade, has recently taken on the responsibility of director of our international security program, but is also head of all of our digital products, and of course was the pioneer who was the first editor of The Interpreter, our digital magazine, which I know probably a lot of you here read on a daily basis. And finally, to my immediate left is Alex Oliver, who's our Director of Research, who manages all of our research output, but for a long time has managed our polling work and our diplomacy work. So again, we have really a terrific panel, and I'd like to thank everybody for juggling their diaries and reshuffling things so that you can be here for this discussion. So I want to get through about 3 or 4 big issues, and I want to spend about half an hour doing that, and then I'm going to come to the audience. So please start thinking of your questions, and I'm looking forward to a forest of hands in about 25 minutes or half an hour. I want to start with the hardest question that I've received from the media, both this time round but also the time of the last putsch and the one before that, and that is, why is this happening? Why have we gone from one of the most stable democracies in the world, and indeed a country that both in the Hawke-Keating era and in the Howard era was something of a model in the former case for social democrats in the world and the latter case for conservatives around the world? The Hawke-Keating government won 5 elections in a row, remade the economy, remade the social contract. The Howard government won 4 elections in a row, Many achievements on the economy, brave action on gun laws and other things. Why have we gone from that to where we are now? And the answers that are sometimes given include social media and the rise of the media, which may well be a factor, but it doesn't seem to me to be a complete answer. But I might go to you first, Sam, because you've written just something on this, and then I'll open it up to others. Why is this happening?
Thank you, Michael, and thank you all for coming this evening. I think to answer that question, you first have to ask yourself, well, what's different now than, you know, in What's different now that wasn't the case previously when we had periods of more stable leadership? There is an argument that this is down purely to personalities, and oftentimes people point to two in particular, Kevin Rudd on the Labor side and Tony Abbott on the Liberal side, although there's plenty of blame to spread around among the personalities on both sides of politics. I think that matters. I don't think it's a sufficient explanation. Politicians, like all human beings, have always been venal, self-interested, ambitious. Then again, politicians have always represented what is best about humanity as well. So, yes, there's plenty of blame to spread around about the individuals, but, you know, politics has always been inhabited by unusual personalities. So that seems to me an insufficient explanation. So I tend to look for more systemic factors. And the trend that sticks out, the one that to me is common around the Western world, is the decline of major centre-right and centre-left political parties. Most Western democracies are organised around a handful, in our case two, but in other Western democracies, in, three or four major parties. And the problem is that these big centre-right and centre-left parties no longer have a social base. Australia is an example of this, but it's happening in UK, in Europe and in the US too. In Australia's case, clearly the union movement is in decline. It's now, I believe, according to the ABS, 15% of Australia's workforce belongs to a union. And that challenges really the raison d'etre of the Labor Party. I mean, the Labor Party was founded as the political expression of the union movement. It also poses problems, paradoxically, for the other side, our centre-right party, which was really formed to oppose union power. So when union power declines, not only does that challenge the Labor Party, it also raises awkward questions for the other side. After all, if there are no unions left to battle, then what's the Liberal Party actually for? So I think the trend overall, because of those factors, is declining party membership. And again, this is happening around Western Europe and the UK as well as here, and fewer rusted-on voters who stick loyally to a party for life. Now, nothing I've described there is particularly new. These trends are decades old. But I tend to think that in Australia and elsewhere, it's now really beginning to make an impression on politics. For instance, I think that the Brexit vote and the Trump election can to some extent be explained back, are symptomatic of this trend. And in Australia, I think it's manifested in a different way in the kind of instability that we have seen in the leadership. The two major parties have lost their social base, which means their focus becomes increasingly internal and they lose sight of what their constituents want. After all, political parties such as the Liberal Party and the Labor Party were formed as mass membership organisations designed to give their members a voice, a way to speak to government. But they no longer perform that function. And I think as a result, we see the kind of dysfunction that that comes about when parties are becoming completely internally focused and internally organised.
All right. It's interesting when you said those themes have been around for decades. I remember writing an undergraduate essay on exactly those themes in 1990 in first year government at Sydney University, and it doesn't. What you say makes sense, but whether it is a complete explanation too, I'm not convinced of, because in the sort of 30 years after that, there was enormous stability despite those. I mean, at the time, people were talking a lot about the decline of the union movement, the decline of the mass membership. It's still a bit odd that you'd sort of have no change and then suddenly in 5 or 6 years, you'd suddenly have five prime ministers in 5 years. It does indicate that there's something else at play. But Richard, perhaps I can bring you in. What do you think? Are you convinced by Sam's argument? What do you think is the biggest factor?
Well, I don't know. I mean, Sam has got a, you know, I think that's a reasonable argument. That may in fact be the core of it, but I think there's a cocktail of factors. I think it is about personalities. Kevin Rudd and Tony Abbott both won smashing electoral victories, which have sort of solidified their positions in their own parties, but they somehow managed to alienate so many people around them and in the electorate that people turned on them. That's got to be a factor. I think in the case of Malcolm Turnbull, people dismiss the media. The media's always there, etc. But since coming back to Australia after a long time away this year, to sort of get in touch with the national id, you know, I make sure I listen to Alan Jones in the morning. And listening to Alan Jones, I really feel like I'm living in Venezuela, like a bankrupt, corrupt country which is collapsing all around me. And his listeners are a bit like that as well. They ring in with stories of genocide and this, that, and the other. And that's got to have an impact. I mean, they are Hadley and Jones, Ray Hadley and Jones, are the biggest rating radio show by a long way in the morning. And they have just been at Turnbull, I think, ever since he was elected. So that's got to be a factor as well. I think, you know, social media is probably a factor. I know it's, you know, you can point out exceptions where it doesn't really work or hasn't really had the same impact. I also think that I wonder, you know, we tend to pat ourselves on the back a little bit in Australia that we haven't had a Trump, we haven't had something like Brexit, we haven't had somebody like the Le Pen family in France or AfD in Germany and the like. But, you know, I think in Australia we've had very ineffective populists. I wonder what would happen with an effective populist. Maybe Peter Dutton will be that person soon. And I think that instability within the parties reflects the broader instability in society. It's just being manifested differently than in other countries.
Alex?
Just quickly, I think Richard is right about the cocktail of factors, and I agree with this you know, breaking down of our two-party system. One of the big drivers, I think, though, is globalisation, and this is a development that's happening across the Western world. So the same sort of issues as you raise, Richard, in Europe, in the UK and in the US, which gave rise to Trump and the Le Pens and Front National and the Trump win, others are happening here, but as you say, just less effectively. And there is this rump of disaffected people, which interestingly shows up in our polling, because when we asked Australians for the last 2 years whether they're satisfied or dissatisfied with the direction of the world and the direction of the nation, the majority, nearly 80%, are dissatisfied with the direction of the world, but it was only around 50-50 or 50 who were dissatisfied with the direction of the nation. But when you break that down by political affiliation, it was in fact only one group that was dissatisfied with the direction of the nation in a majority, and that was One Nation voters. The rest of the groups altogether, the Greens, whether they were Green, Liberals, Labor, or any of the independent other party affiliations, all of those were in majority, happy with the direction of the nation. So it seems to me that this globalisation has created this small group of losers who are dissatisfied, who have nowhere else to go and are expressing it in this populist politics and, as you say, haven't yet found an effective enough leader. And both sides of politics are trying to find them.
The last thing I would add is, and it sort of touches on something you were saying, Richard, is it does seem to me that for some of these reasons, a brutal and pitiless culture has developed in Parliament House, and conventions have broken down. And I wonder whether we underrate the importance of political conventions here. And it does seem to me the more one thinks about the rolling of Mr. Rudd in 2010, that was like a gateway drug to a permanent addiction to this kind of political misbehaviour. Because once you've done that kind of thing once, it's suddenly conceivable, it's thinkable, and people return to it.
Both parties have done it once and it's going to blow up in both their faces, then maybe they'll stop for a while.
Well, that's we said last time and the time before that. All right, let me come to a second question, and that is, how is all of this regarded overseas? So I think a lot of us have been looking at each other and saying, we feel this makes us look ridiculous. Richard, you've written, you've written for international titles and you've lived overseas for a long time. What do you think? How do you think this affects Australia's reputation as a serious country? Does it make it harder, do you think, for the Australian government to achieve what it wants to achieve in the international sphere?
Yeah, well, I mean, some countries pay a lot of attention to Australia. Some countries pay little attention to Australia and the peoples within them. So there's a range of reactions, you know, puzzled, bemused, perplexed, annoyed, For example, in the case of the Pacific nations, where we won't have an Australian Prime Minister represented at the Pacific Summit, even though in theory we're putting a whole lot of new and renewed effort in aid and all that into rebuilding relations with the Pacific nations because of China. If you have a look at, one thing that Malcolm Turnbull did pull off during his prime ministership was a summit of ASEAN nations earlier this year in Sydney, which was, quite a big deal. He was following that up in 2 weeks with a trip to Indonesia, Malaysia, Vietnam, and then Nauru. Now, I think Scott Morrison is going to go to Indonesia, not the other countries. So a lot of the sort of work that Australia has done in an attempt to sort of build its profile commitment to ASEAN countries, which ASEAN and the region generally, and individual countries within that, which is vital if we're going to give ourselves greater options in dealing with China and dealing with the changing region generally, that a lot of that is getting sort of washed away. Turnbull had relations with Macron and Merkel. That's all gone. So I think there's it's not to say that everything that coming out of those relations would have been good or not, but the sort of, consistency, ability to deal with people in a more intimate fashion, all of that is sort of gone. And we will probably have to start again, I guess, on the assumption that Labor will win next May. So it's a kind of massive wasted opportunity cost.
Sam?
Well, I agree. It makes us look a little ridiculous internationally, and yet we're in pretty good company. There wouldn't be many Americans that you come across who would feel like they've got the moral high ground on this question when it comes to the dysfunction in their political system. I think the same would go for many Brits that you run into on the street, and even democracies throughout Western Europe. So we're hardly Robinson Crusoe, and actually, I think I would disagree slightly with Richard that this is somehow that the politics is manifesting is a reflection of a broader social crisis. I actually don't think that is the case. I think this is
discontent, not crisis.
Forgive me. Yes, you said broader instability in society. Yeah. I tend to think this is purely a political phenomenon, particularly in Australia. I mean, Australia is still a very, happy, wealthy, and actually even pretty well-run place by international standards. And so I think the crisis that we're seeing in Australian politics is really one that's engendered by purely political factors and is not really a reflection of any broad social movement at all.
All right, Alex, do you want to? Okay, let me move on to the third question. Let me talk about legacies of some of the figures who are leaving the stage, and let me start with the PM, the former PM, I should say, Mr. Turnbull. My sense of him is that he was a capable and worldly Prime Minister who didn't really have the time or space to significantly affect Australia's place in the world. I think that's how I would summarise it. I think that he, in the international arena, I think he dealt with President Trump as well as any Western leader has done. I think he had a success with some counterparts in resuscitating the TPP when Mr. Trump walked away from it. I think the relationship with China waxed and waned. Probably got to a sort of a reasonable equilibrium in the last few weeks, but you would have to say that like other PMs from the last decade, he hasn't really been in office long enough or securely enough to really make a significant difference to international relations. I do think that in foreign policy, time at the crease matters. If you're there for a long time, you get more and more experience, more knowledge, more confidence. Not that many people have accused Mr. Turnbull of lacking confidence, but confidence in that international sphere, relationships that allow you to have more and more influence. And I think when you're Prime Minister for a couple of years, two or three years, it's hard to do that. So that would be, I think, my sort of week one summary of looking back at the Turnbull years. What do other people think? Alex, I know
we've got some numbers,
yeah.
But they're early.
Like
I like numbers. But there were early numbers, so this was before the Trumbull phone call. But then again, you know, there's plenty of people who have difficulties dealing with Donald Trump. We polled in 2006 on how Australians thought their prime ministers had done on the foreign policy
2016.
Front. 2016, sorry. Unsurprisingly, John Howard came top with 82% saying he'd done a good job, Rudd at 69%, and Turnbull about equivalent at 68%. Now, there were some big differences in this because Tony Abbott was rated at about 46% of doing a good job. So I think that probably does stem from the fact that Australians saw him as statesmanlike, and you know, he acted well on the world stage, you know, the Trump matter notwithstanding. I think he can be given a lot of credit for resurrecting with the Japanese TPP-11. And it wasn't just Trump who walked away, it was Trudeau who threatened to walk away. And apparently he did, Prime Minister Turnbull did a very good job there of handling that. And it was a very difficult moment in those negotiations. And I think Australia played a big part in bringing that TPP-11 back together again. So I think he did have some achievements. I think there will be people who know far better than I, but I think he built a better relationship with President Tokoi and got to the point where we were going to do the impossible and finally conclude this free trade agreement with Indonesia. So I think you're right that he wasn't given quite enough time to establish that, but I think the seeds were there for a good Prime Minister on foreign policy.
Richard, what about Turnbull on China?
Well, I guess that's one thing he's going to be remembered for. in different ways by his supporters and critics. I think in some respects you might say it was the right policy but very poorly executed at many different turns. I wasn't here during all of that, but, you know, there's no nice way to push back against China, and but I think Mr. Turnbull, by his rhetoric, probably made it worse. You know, he was a weak prime minister at the time, presented with Sam Dastyari's head on a plate. And, you know, that caused a big ruckus in the way he handled that in Beijing. As you said, we've had the reset last week or so. But, of course, the reset is followed by the way the Huawei decision was announced in the middle of the leadership contest. And that's going to have to play out as well. So I think the truth is that, and I think China now, of course, is probably not going to bother much with Australia. I doubt Senator Payne will go there. You know, China will go back to what their plan B was all along, which is to kind of wait for regime change in Australia and wait for the Labor Party to come to power. I mean, they might think they will get a bit better deal with Labor. I'm not so sure the policy will change that much. But I think whatever happens, and maybe Turnbull will have got back to this position, maybe Mr. Shorten, if he's elected, will get to this position, we're going to have to find a way to have a relationship which can manage tensions with China, because there's always going to be tensions and difficulties. And I think the Huawei case is another example of that.
Sam, did you want to say something?
Just wanted to add on the China relationship, which I think is, you know, in future going to be the most important relationship for Australia. It's the biggest challenge. The rise of China is the biggest challenge that Australia has faced, I think, since the Second World War. And I think we'd all agree that you know, maintaining a good relationship with China is not an end in itself. I mean, if that was the objective, then we would just become a sort of supplicant to China. But, of course, the objective is our, you know, to maintain Australia's national interest in the face of a country that has a number of objectives that are, you know, contrary to ours. And I think on that score, you have to give Turnbull credit, first of all, for, you know, overseeing the foreign interference legislation. I think that's an important landmark for how Australia faces a rising China. I think I would also say that in regard to the foreign policy white paper of 2016, the way I'd characterise that, the way it talked about China, is that Turnbull, in a sense, oversaw the end of the beginning of the new relationship with China. So it's now, it's a document that makes it clear that we're entering a new era where, with the United States in relative decline and China clearly aiming to become the strongest power in the region. And so Turnbull sort of set a landmark there for saying, okay, Australia's going to have to really step up into this new world.
I'll just add quickly to that. Often people say, oh, nobody cares overseas what happens in Australia. But I think the China issue has been closely watched, not just in the US, but also in Canada, in Germany, in UK, in France, and the like, which are all in different ways are renegotiating their relationship with China or discussing their relationship with China internally. So we were sort of leading with our chin a little bit and out in front of the pack. But I think it has been very closely watched. And in fact, that's one reason why China has been so angry with Australia. It's not just the level of rhetoric. It's not just the foreign interference legislation. It's they think we've been going around the world telling everybody else, you've got to wise up as well. There may be some truth in that. When people look at Turnbull, that's what they'll be looking at.
Alex, what about Julie Bishop? She gave her final press conference today in the Senate courtyard at Parliament House. Very classy performance. Didn't say much about her future options, but you wrote a nice piece about her legacy. How would you sum it up?
I wrote it because on the same day, Prime Minister Turnbull, he was, I think, still Prime Minister, the other hadn't been sworn in yet, said that she was Australia's finest foreign minister. And I had to think about that, because it's sort of discussion that, you know, we have in places like this. And I wanted to do that justice and really thought about what she did. And I know that there will be others who would say that she had no grand strategy for dealing with Australia's place in the world in very difficult times. And I did wonder whether that should in fact be the measure of success as a foreign minister. And I think if we asked a polling question, which we might think about doing next year, on who has been Australia's finest foreign minister, I think she would be rated very well by the Australian public. She was extremely hardworking. Clearly she was popular, and all of the polling figures show that, including News Poll today. She was an indefatigable campaigner, and she will be a real loss to the Liberal Party if they lose her at the next election, because she was really instrumental in getting them across the line last time by just campaigning right around Australia for her colleagues. She was fabulous on social media, and that really endeared her to a population not just in Australia but also abroad. She was very good at cultivating those relationships with her counterparts in other countries. She had some signature policies which she really pursued very vigorously. The new Colombo plan, which will see up to about 40,000 Australians by, I think, 2020, having travelled overseas on a scholarship to Asia to learn about Asia and its culture and languages. Aid, I know she's been criticised for not quarantining the aid budget from cuts. The aid budget has been cut savagely by around 25% since the Abbott government came in. But what she did do, and I know she fought her colleagues hard and, the Razor gang at budget time, to at least quarantine the Pacific from that. And, in fact, the Pacific and PNG have not seen any aid cuts since that time, which I think has been credit to her. And on other important issues, the consular function is actually where the Department of Foreign Affairs and the Foreign Minister really interact with ordinary Australian people. And they regard that as a really important role. When we've polled about what Australians' foreign policy goals should be, they put consular affairs right up there, which is protecting the interests of Australians abroad. And she really did that well. She reined in what I say were the excesses of her predecessors in allowing that to really take over the newspapers and to indulge Australians who've done stupid things overseas and allow that media coverage to go untrammelled. And she really focused on the important things like relationships with the families in MH17, fighting for access to the site after the MH17 downing, the Bali 9. She did an absolutely stellar job of trying to get those two young men off death row, and the fact that she failed was really nothing to do with her. And then she was a great diplomat, I think, as Australia's chief diplomat. I think obviously the job that she did with MH17 in the UN was really she presented herself as a very firm and indomitable character. I think as a chief diplomat, she did make those relationships with her counterparts in other countries. And then finally, she really lifted the profile of the ministry. Now, Foreign Affairs is not a ministry that really has a great sort of popular interface. I think when it comes to budget time, nobody really cares what happens, because it's not jobs and it's not health and hospitals and education, and she really lifted the ministry so that that the function of foreign policy has become more popular, and I think that is really credit to her. So they were my initial observations, and we'll have some time to think about it at leisure.
All right, I'm going to hold the questions on the new appointees to some of these positions, because I want to go first to the audience and give you an opportunity to ask some questions. So I might come back on Mr. Morrison and Senator Payne and others, but first of all, let me go to the audience and see who would like to ask a question. Now, I was hoping for a forest of hands. Yes, sir. So I'm going to, old friend of the Institute, and I'll ask everybody who asks a question to wait for the microphone and then tell us your name and affiliation before you ask a question.
Yes. Robert Millican, I'm a journalist, and I would just like to pick up on something Richard said and perhaps preempt your next topic, Michael, but I think the burning question is, what are the challenges for foreign policy in the next 6 months, in the next year for Australia in the light of all this? I mean, it may be very tiresome that we've got to go through it all yet again, but have there been indications from Scott Morrison, Maurice Payne, to indicate that the main thrust of foreign policy, particularly towards China and Asia, will just go on as before or change in any significant ways?
Might start with you, Richard. What, reading the tea leaves, we don't know much. It's all pretty speculative at this point. But are there any themes in relation to China and Asia and the new team that you would observe?
Well, I just think till the election, whoever's in charge is minding the store. There's no room for great initiatives. The focus, and we might come back to Mr. Morrison, I think he's a much more domestically focused politician than Mr. Turnbull, for example. He's going to be even more so, given we're leading up to an election. We could have an early election. So one just hopes that they can maintain relationships, maintain positions. We can make sure we are represented at big forums. The big ones coming up are APEC and the East Asia Summit. Sometimes we often used to decry, for example, because of US electoral cycles when the Americans didn't turn up. I really hope we manage to make sure we're there and properly represented. But I can't see that there's anything much they can do on the big relationships. They wouldn't be disturbing the US relationship. I don't think China's going to do much to, particularly after the Huawei decision, to embrace this new leadership, particularly when they know there's an election soon. So I think it's about sort of not stuffing it up any further.
Sam or Alex, do you want to add anything on the Morrison government? Or the Morrison Prime Ministership, perhaps?
Just quickly, because you talked about relationships, Robert, but I think there's some big toxic issues, and I think this is where Morrison will really make a difference, and they are on immigration and climate change. And the NEG is obviously the issue that brought this all to a head, this leadership change, and the issue of how to deal with climate change and whether we abide by the Paris commitments has obviously not been resolved. And I think that's going to be something we will watch, and they will be addressing in the 9 months. So while they're sort of a caretaker government, really, this issue is something that they're going to have to address. So I think sort of watch this space. There, I think the Liberal Party is really out of step with the rest of the Australian population. Everything that we've seen indicates that there is a rising concern about climate change, that the latest indications in the last couple of days that this is going to be an energy policy focused on fossil fuels, to the detriment of a focus on renewables, and that is exactly the opposite of what the Australian population is looking for, based on what we hear from our representative polling across the nation every year. Concern about climate change is rising, and 84% of Australians this year said in response to that specific question, and in the context of debates about energy pricing and reliability and affordability and security, in the context of exactly that debate, the answer to the question about whether they should focus on fossil fuels or on renewables, the response was 84% saying we should focus on renewables. So I think the Liberal Party saying their base is concerned about price and price alone, I think that misreads it. I think it's more complicated than that, and that's going to be a really difficult issue. And then, of course, there's the immigration issue. And with the immigration portfolio and his background, that there are going to be some moves, I think, to bring down the rate of immigration. And it's not obviously just an international policy issue. It has a strong domestic element, but I think that it's going to be a real issue in the next 9 months too.
I might just add a couple of things before I go to the next person I saw. I mean, I agree with what you've just said. I think it does feel like the government is limbering up to say more on reducing immigration numbers even further. Of course, they've done that by shifting from immigration targets to an immigration cap, and the overall numbers of skilled migrants has decreased, I think, by about 20,000 in the last financial year. You do get the sense that if Mr. Dutton had won the Prime Ministership, that would have been probably the most important issue and the biggest difference that he was setting up between himself, his government and the opposition. Probably not so much on, not quite as much when it comes to Mr. Morrison. It's interesting that he separated the immigration portfolio out from the rest of Home Affairs to put a handbrake on Mr. Dutton, as one commentator speculated. But I think this is an issue that we're all going to have to think very hard about. In terms of Mr. Morrison, Richard and I were having a chat in the corridor the other day. There are different sort of signs if you think about his thinking in his past. On the one hand, as a treasurer, he spoke from this forum stage 2 years ago, and gave a speech which was very much an internationalist speech. It was a speech about the advantages of the open economic model that Australia has. But again, as Richard says, he is a more domestically focused person. Malcolm Turnbull loved thinking about these big international movements. I think Mr. Morrison is a much more political character, much more focused on domestic issues. And as Richard said, he's 9 months out from an election. In terms of a banana skin to watch, because you mentioned challenges, how about a Mr. Trump-shaped banana skin? Mr. Morrison had a phone call with Mr. Trump. He invited Mr. Trump to visit Australia when he was down here for the APEC meeting in Port Moresby. Every Western leader has struggled with how you deal with somebody like Mr. Trump. How do you deal with somebody who, on the one hand, is the most important person in the world, on the other hand, is a completely obnoxious person who is grossly discourteous and ungracious, as he's demonstrated in the last 24 hours by refusing to lower the flags at the White House to half staff in honour of Senator McCain, the late Senator McCain. So this is a person who, and different Western leaders have tried different approaches. Some have tried to sort of clutch him to them, as Theresa May did, and he responded by reaching out to her opponent, her rival Boris Johnson, and by making all sorts of inflammatory remarks in a press conference that he held with her. Other leaders have tried to maintain a distance and they've been punished, like Chancellor Merkel. So I don't think anybody has resolved this, but I think that may well be one to watch, especially if Mr. Trump ends up spending some time here on the way to Moresby.
I was going to add on one. It was right of Alex to raise the immigration issue, but I mean, Australia is, if it wants, is quite entitled to cut the immigration rate. Mm. It's just as long as there's not a race baiting along with it. Mm. That's the concern. I mean, you might make out an argument to slow immigration down a little bit for all sorts of reasons, but it's the race element that is the thing that, you know, we should be worried about.
Yes. Well, I guess there's the race issue. There's also a general sense, I'm speaking very personally as we all are now, but there is a sense in which the debate on immigration is just becoming more negative. And whereas previously, we used to look, I think, at the positive sides of immigration, it does seem to me that we increasingly think about immigration mainly as a negative, at least in the public debate. So there's the question of the numbers, but just a question of also where we see immigration fitting in our national story. And I think even a few years ago, I mean, I probably bored my colleagues on this, but the John Howard solution to the issue of migration and public opinion was to close down the borders, but jack up the numbers of legal migrants. And the number of skilled migrant arrivals really increased drastically in the last few years before 2007, even as he made border protection his signature issue in terms of refugees. But that sort of equilibrium now doesn't seem to be politically attractive. Here ends the Fully Love editorial. Madam, I saw the lady in the second row was the next hand I saw with the glass. Yes, thank you.
Sorry. Yeah, it just really annoys me that these breaks in a stable party really get in the way of proper work that the government could be doing. And, you know, these relationships that need to be constantly rebuilt with our closest neighbours just takes up time and get in the way of making important decisions. and ongoing commitments, keeping those, you know, and just how much does this all cost would be very interesting.
Well, all right, let me put this to Sam and Alex. How much does it cost? If you have a number, Alex, that'd be great. But if you don't have a dollar figure, how does operationally it cost us? How does it affect us, Sam or Alex? How does it affect the business that we do in the world, do you think?
Let me take a liberty here and address the question in a slightly different way, which is to try and tap into the frustration that is there in the question, which we all feel about the way the country is being governed right now. And I'm going to make myself unpopular here and suggest that it may be all of our fault. It's very easy to blame the political class for this, but to go back to the argument that I began with, Australians, and not just Australians, it's happening in Western democracies around the world, are pulling back from political life and from political activity. They don't join political parties anymore, or unions, or churches, or civic organisations, certainly not at the rates they used to. So if you don't like the way politics is being conducted, if you're frustrated, then join in.
So physician, heal thyself. All right, Alex.
Well, yes, Sam, you said it wasn't about broader social trends, but that's exactly it. I mean, people aren't joining political parties because there's something else going on. You know, there's this disaffection with politics, and part of that is manifesting itself in this rise, this, you know, populist nationalist rise of sentiment that we see around the Western world. So you can't just tell people that they must join up to a political party. There are reasons there are not, and we've got very good numbers on these reasons. There are only 60% of Australians, and in fact that number is similar around the Western world, who think that democracy is the best form of government. And around nearly 50% of young Australians, and that group of younger Australians is actually getting older and older, they're now not just under 30s, they're under 40s, so the Gen Ys are sort of taking their disaffection with politics into their adult lives. They're not actually growing up. They're grown up, they still don't like it. They don't like the way that politics is delivering democracy in Australia, and this is something that's happening around the world. So who blames them for not joining up to political parties if they see nothing in those political parties or in the way that they operate that reflects how they want to see the world governed or Australia governed? So that's my answer to you, to say that there's no broader social trends at play here. I think there are much broader social trends at play here, and what you're seeing is a symptom and not the cause. But as to the costs, I think this is hugely costly. Obviously, we now have to, the government, the bureaucracy now has to brief a whole new government. That's costly, it's time consuming, it's frustrating for them. The bureaucrats run around just doing the same sort of things they've done, you know, 2.5 years ago that they do every time there's a leadership change or a government change, and they'll have to do it all again in 9 months' time. So that's costly just in purely practical terms for just how much it costs us as a taxpayer to have our paid public servants running around briefing the next generation, in inverted commas, of Australian leaders. Sorry, that's my rant for the moment.
Of course, if millennials are frustrated but they couldn't be bothered joining a political party, they can always just come along to more Lowy Institute events if they want to get engaged. Now, the next gentleman I saw was here.
My name's Alexander Galanos. I'm a lawyer at Kingwood Mellisons. I've been living in New York for the last 5 years.
Welcome
which has
home.
Been, thank you. And have been listening to all the podcasts that I can
thank
get.
You.
So
thank
thanks
you.
To everybody for their time and comments. What are we to make of DFAT's review of soft power? And do we think it's constructive? Is it meaningful? And what kind of outcomes and deliverables should we look for? Thanks.
Alex, you want to have a go at that?
Thank you, Michael. haven't got around to writing my submission yet, so you're just making me feel guilty. Look, I think this is probably a Bishop initiative. I haven't thought about it very deeply, about what its genesis is or what, in fact, it can achieve. Government has been struggling with the idea of soft power for a long time. It's always been, it hasn't been given much attention, you know, hard power, whether it be in security and defence or economics, always gets the greater attention. We had a big kerfuffle in the last decade about whether the Department of Foreign Affairs should be funding, for example, our international broadcasting services. And that was just a little illustration of just how Department of Foreign Affairs saw the role of soft power and what they did for soft power, which is public diplomacy. So they axed the Australia network, which was quite an important component of our soft power abroad, was showing Australian lifestyles, television programs, news and foreign affairs to the region. They then, having axed that, I think that then put a lot of pressure on the ABC and the way that it conducted its broadcasting. And we got to the point now where we've axed shortwave to the Pacific. Now, that's an important component of our soft power to the Pacific. It was a crucial crucial service that we provided to the Pacific, many of which nations couldn't afford to have their own, you know, reliable public service broadcasts and having news about the region and about Australia to the region and about the world to the region. So there are a couple of, and there is a separate broadcasting review underway as well, and I think it's not coincidental that the soft power review and the broadcasting review are happening at the same time. But then there's a bigger question about sort of what is branding, what is Australia's branding and what does that do for soft power? Now, I think it was Prime Minister Morrison, in fact, who was responsible for the Where the Head Bloody Hell Way campaign. So he's obviously
Ambassador Bingle, yes.
Yes, and so he's got that sort of branding hat on when he thinks about soft power possibly. But soft power is a lot more than branding, and Australia's always been a bit confused about soft power. And it's not about the television campaign that you run for Tourism Australia. It's about a lot more than that, and it's about projecting our nation and all its values and its democracy and its open society and its culture to the world, and it's not just about the television campaign. So it'll be an interesting review, and I hope I'll get around to writing something about it.
And it's also about projecting your country as a serious country, right, that has its act together, it's led by a government that has its mojo, that has interesting things to say about the world. So you can have a bureaucratic review and you can assign some funding to it, but fundamentally, if your politics is broken, that is a drain on your soft power.
We just had a soft power bad moment last week.
We had a soft power outage last week, I think. I think, yes, madam.
Dr. Irina Zaborcev, I'm currently looking for a new affiliation. I'd like also to thank panel for your insights on challenging issues Australia is going through. Speaking about high costs of political instability, both national and international, in terms of soft power, and also at the very beginning, you've mentioned the role of social media and impact of social media on political trends. Australians express a lot of dissatisfaction that while they're fine to express their will, their will is not actually taken into account. Do you think these changes might prompt to rethink voting system, maybe to think about new emendations to the system so to ensure the stability?
Changes to the voting system, yes. Did you say? All right. Well, let me open it up. Are there structural changes we should make to our political system, whether it's changes to the voting system, which might be compulsory or optional voting, or the term of parliament? Are there changes like that that would make a difference, do you think, Richard, as someone who is a gallery journalist?
I think the compulsory voting system is good, actually, for politics generally. If you look at the US, for example, that's the debate that Kevin Rudd's been having in recent days. He thinks that the initiative, I guess, he said he brought forward, I guess it was him, giving the Labor Party a mix of the elected caucus and members, I think is about 50-50.
For the Labor leadership.
For the Labor leadership, yep. Has helped stabilise the Labor Party. If you look at the way it was done in UK Labor, the actually rank and file in UK Labor has a much, much greater vote in the leadership, and that's why they have Jeremy Corbyn. And that's, you can see what that, now I think the Labor Party is captive of that because the Corbyn supporters can always have a greater, more members joining at a branch level and can keep him there or somebody like him. Then you get the other view, John Howard, who in recent weeks has been arguing, arguing against the Liberal Party adopting the Labor Party's method. He says it's not a problem. It wasn't a problem when I was there so much, or we handled it at least. We don't need to go down the sort of, half caucus, half membership plebiscite role. Now, I don't know what works, actually. I think I'm starting to think that the Labor design was quite artful, a role for the membership without having the members dominate it. And maybe the Liberals will have a debate about that and think about doing it.
And Richard, what about this old chestnut of increasing parliamentary terms from, say, 3 years to 4 years? Would that be a good idea?
Well, I think it's probably a good idea, but, you know, it gets into this thing in Australia, you know, it was like the Republic debate, you know, the politician's republic, and somebody would portray this as feather bedding for politicians. Mm. Once that starts, it's very hard to argue against it. One shouldn't feel sorry for politicians, but they are dealing, I think, as Sam said, with people like us. Mm. We can hold 50 different contradictory views in our head at one time. When they have to manage that, the whole machine pounces on them. Mm. And that's extremely difficult, particularly with Twitter and the like, where it's happening every 5 seconds.
Mm. Well, typically, I think governments tend to like the idea of four-year terms, and oppositions tend to dislike the idea. All right, I'm going to take a couple of questions because we're running out of time. There's a gentleman at the back and John McCarthy. All right, we'll take those two final questions. Yes, sir.
Thank you. My name is James Hamlin. I'm an investor. Just a quick question for the panel. I was hoping we could do a bit of crystal ball gazing, and I was just wondering your thoughts on, is there anything different about this leadership change, regardless of whether it's the Liberal or Labor Party going forward? Are we doomed to repeat this again?
Okay, thank you. And John will take your question at the same time, if that's all right.
Basically, when people come into new jobs in government, it takes about a year to get across the material. Mm-hmm. And that's one big issue when you change ministers the whole time. The second is that when you're talking about foreign policy deployment or external deployment, you're not just talking about the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister. You're talking about the Trade Minister, the Defence Minister, Minister of Immigration, and a couple of others. So what you're seeing in terms of name recognition and capacity of other governments to deal with people is you're not just seeing a problem of one or two, you're seeing the problem compounded to six or seven, which means that there are real difficulties in other governments getting through on a personal level to a new government in Australia if this happens every 6 months or a year or so.
They're terrific comments. Let me give each panel an opportunity, maybe in the same order in which I started, to address either of these questions. First of all, what's different this time and what might happen in the future? And also, as John says, it's not just at the summit. There's a cascading effect where there's a whole new team, including a new Foreign Minister, Senator Payne, a new Defence Minister, Mr. Pine, new Immigration and Trade Ministers, and so on. So, Richard, the panel should feel free to take one or both of those, Richard.
First, I mean, who knows? But, you know, if Labor wins, then the stakes of triggering that are even higher than they have been in opposition, where we've had the shortened sort of Albanese sort of dance. But, you know, in theory, Shorten, whatever you think of him, has been effective. He's always set tests. He always passes them. But he's not a popular person. So if that comes into play, I guess it's possible. And to John's point, I think is a very good one, not just the across the government thing, but being Prime Minister is a difficult job. You have to learn how to do it. You have to learn, and you learn by failing. And so Scott Morrison needs time because he's, you know, it's difficult for anybody out of the block. So I think it's going to be very tough for him.
I agree with John, so I don't have much to add on that point. On the other question, are we doomed to repeat this cycle? I think emphatically, yes, we are. None of the things that I talked about at the beginning have been in any way resolved. They're not likely to reverse themselves. To address the point that Michael made after my comments at the outset, I think the reason why it's true that the trends away from the major parties have been going on for decades. The reason why it's taken so long for them to have a real effect, particularly in Australia, is because the voting system in the House of Representatives is heavily biased towards the two major parties. But the continuing decline in the primary vote of the two major parties means that now the unpopularity of the parties is starting to butt up against that natural advantage that they have. And so increasingly we see, you know, a one-seat majority. We've seen a minority government in the case of Gillard. And I think that is the future. I think Australia faces a future with shorter terms of government and potentially many more minority governments with small parties and independents likely to make up the numbers and even, you know, form part of a cabinet conceivably. So I think when I said join in before, I didn't necessarily mean join in with the old parties. I think there's never been a better time, if you're politically motivated, to become an independent candidate for a seat or to join a small party.
Sam's going to have a stall for both parties out there to sign up now. Alex?
Well, this one is different because the winning Prime Minister was not the agitator, so that's different. But then again, there's only 9 months to go to another election, so whether, you know, the prospect of him being toppled, they might just be toppled in the next election. And I see Sam's point, I get it, that this isn't going to change, and I think we are heading towards more minority governments. And both, as I said before, both parties are competing for the disaffected vote, whether they be disaffected Paul and Hanson One Nation voters or whether they be disaffected people in the middle who don't feel that, you know, parties that are moving to the right and to the left are representing their interests. You know, there's a time now for the Australian Moderates Party, you know, that a party that actually avowedly sits in the middle, that is not being torn to the edges. So I think we are going to see the same thing happen over and over again until we resolve this problem of what do we do with the great middle. Compulsory voting is a fabulous thing because it makes the middle vote and turn out to vote, and is the only thing actually that brings the disaffected young voters into the sphere of politics because they have to vote. That's the only way they interact with Australian politics these days. I think that's a good thing.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've run out of time. I'm going to make a couple of closing remarks, but let me just give you a quick ad for two events coming up this week. If you enjoyed this one, then listen to these. Tomorrow we have a lunchtime event on US policy in Asia, which will be chaired, I think, by my colleague Alex Oliver, and will include Richard McGregor, Ewan Graham from the Lowy Institute, and also Gordon Flake, the CEO of the Perth US Asia Centre. And on Thursday night, I'm delighted to say we'll be hosting the Samoan Prime Minister Tui Laiepa to talk about the new geostrategic landscape in the Pacific, and details are available on the website. The final comments I wanted to make, first of all, I'd like to thank... We've talked about Mr. Turnbull, we've talked about Ms. Bishop and these other characters, but I'd like to thank Malcolm Turnbull and Julie Bishop for their service. I think, thank you very much. They, I think politicians do get a hard rap, as Richard mentioned, and they make a great deal of sacrifices, and they, no doubt they both made mistakes, but I'd like to thank them and also wish very best of luck to the new team, to Mr. Morrison and to the new Foreign Minister and Defence Minister and Trade Minister. Of course, we hope to host them all here in different formats. So look forward to some invitations there. Sam, I think, was right by saying that we're not Robinson Crusoe in all this, and it's true that the UK and the US is doing equally poorly. I would remind you, though, Sam, of that great Andrew Denton song from our childhood, "I Don't Care How We Go As Long As We Beat New Zealand." And unfortunately, we are not beating New Zealand at the moment. New Zealand is streets ahead with a functioning government led by a popular prime minister, so we've got some ground to make up. The final comment I'll make, perhaps, in honour of the fact that Mr. Turnbull has left the lodge, is just to conclude by saying perhaps we're being too negative about this, and perhaps he was right all along when he said there's never been a more exciting time to be alive. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much.